Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's episode of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. As usual, we are joined every Monday by our friend Doug Keck of EWTN. And we're talking today about the National Eucharistic Revival that took place this summer. It was a life-changing event for thousands of Catholics. Numerous testimonies are still pouring in to this day. And we want to look back at some of these stories with Doug Keck. And in particular, we also want to talk about how it was a true Eucharistic movement. In fact, to be very clear, the National Eucharistic Congress of the United States of America made global waves, so much so that at the International Eucharistic Congress that took place in Ecuador this year, stories of the National Eucharistic Congress were discussed, which tells us that Christ is moving in a powerful way through his substantial presence. We'll also talk about a coffee table book that was released by EWTN called A Eucharistic Movement, Stories and Pictures from the National Eucharistic Revival. We move on from there to speak with Jonathan Liddell about seven ways that the Synod on Synodality can still change the Church. The most controversial issues may be off the agenda, as we well know, for next month's Synod on Synodality's session in Rome. But make no mistake about it, the October 2nd to the 27th gathering could still lead to several big changes that impact, potentially, daily life in the lives of Catholics across not just the United States, but also the world. And it's important that we understand what this means for us, what kind of ramifications we might be looking at, and also how much hope we have moving forward. And then finally, we speak with Dr. Stephen Doran about the question of consciousness. Now, this is a question that continues to crop up in terms of scientific discussions about the human person. It's a particularly vexing question to consider when we talk about end-of-life questions and issues, questions about euthanasia, assisted suicide, questions about death and when to pull the plug, all of these things. These are crucial questions. Dying well should be as big a concern for us as living well morally. And this question of consciousness is one that's touted in the scientific sphere, but it has ramifications in terms of how we consider the human soul, what consciousness actually means in light of theology and philosophy of the Church, and how we as faithful Catholics can properly respond to the question of, well, is the person possessing of consciousness and therefore possessing the dignity of the human person? All of this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, September 23rd. It's the Feast of St. Padre Pio. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Pope Francis wants to raise awareness of the condition of those who are held prisoner. In his Sunday Angelus prayer, the Pope said prisoners must be treated with dignity, noting that everyone makes mistakes. The pontiff emphasized the purpose of prison is to enable inmates to resume an honest life afterwards. The Department of Justice says Ryan Roof, the man suspected of an assassination attempt on former President Trump in Florida, wrote letters about his plan and stalked Trump. Former state and federal prosecuting attorney David Weinstein discussed the letter.
I am so sorry I failed. This was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump. So I'm not sure how he could foresee the future, since this letter was contained within a box that was deposited before he even traveled to South Florida.
Weinstein says the letter filed with today's pleading for pretrial detention is damning and will likely spark additional federal charges against Ruth. Lebanese officials say Israeli airstrikes killed nearly 300 people and injured hundreds of others today. NBC's Raf Sanchez reports from Tel Aviv.
This is by far the most extensive set of strikes we have seen in the time that Israel and Hezbollah have been skirmishing across the border since October 8th.
Israel has warned Lebanese citizens to evacuate from areas where it says Hezbollah has been storing weapons. The Pentagon said the move to send a smaller number of troops to the region is out of an abundance of caution. Former President Trump says it's too late to hold another debate. Speaking at a rally in North Carolina Saturday, Trump said there shouldn't be another presidential debate because voting has already started in some states. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, my guest, Doug Keck, President and CEO of EWTN. And we are talking today about the National Eucharistic Congress, memories of it, stories from it, and a new coffee table book entitled A Eucharistic Movement, Stories and Pictures from the National Eucharistic Revival. Doug, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Well, it's great to be on with you again. Thank you, Marcus.
Oh, you're very welcome. So you spoke with Monsi Alvarado about this new coffee table book, which is a snapshot of the National Eucharistic Revival as a movement and stories that are coming out of it. So tell us about
exactly.
it. Right, exactly. Tell us about it, please. Well, we seem to have lost Doug for a bit, and as we endeavor to get him back on, let's talk about the National Eucharistic Congress itself. To this day, we at Ave Maria Radio continue to receive stories about some of the most moving talks that they had heard at the National Eucharistic Congress. They tout it as this movement of great revival that explored not only things like the love of God, which is a perennial gospel theme, but also the theme of sin and salvation, and even things like the mystical role of, say, a deacon as liturgical servant and the Eucharistic bridge that brings together the work of the altar and the life of the people.
And that had been worked on for a couple of years by our people before it happened. And, you know, they had great plans for it. And people were concerned for a while that it wasn't going to be as popular as it turned out to be, 60,000 people. So they were very happy with that. And obviously there was a whole work up and walk up to it in the sense of the Eucharistic processions that were done from the four corners of the country.
Right.
That, of course, we reported on throughout. Father Roger Landry participated, who does a lot of work with us. Also, Monsi Alvarado was one of the three co-hosts, so she was heavily involved. And so actually we had talked on a recent bookmark that's airing now on the new book, which really had come out of, had not been planned at all, but during the event, everybody was so taken away by the power of the Spirit there and the beautiful imagery. Much of which could be seen on television as we aired it, and so much so that there were people who actually got up and said, I've got to go, I've got to be part of this. Mm-hmm. And the idea came to say, gee, we have these pictures that are being taken and snapped as the event occurred. Maybe this would be a beautiful memory book for those who've been there, and also a wonderful coffee table book, maybe to enhance your own home, and maybe the kind of thing that somebody might pick up and start looking at and open up a conversation.
And that's the hope, right? It's not just about the books opening up a conversation. They also continue to be snapshots into this great event that we keep tapping into, this Eucharistic grace, because Christ was, as you mentioned, processed from the four corners of this nation to the National Eucharistic Congress. Something is happening in the spiritual sphere, even if we don't see it.
Absolutely, and I think it's really important. And Mother Angelica, obviously, was at the forefront of Eucharistic adoration and Eucharistic processions. You know, we always had those processions at Corpus Christi, which we televised. And so you have that kind of a situation. You have the Napa Institute and Tim Bush writing about the importance of those processions they've had in New York. They're going to have another one coming up in October. Powerful public witnesses of our belief in the real presence. And that's what we really need. We need that to break out and for people to be reminded that's really Jesus in the Eucharist, and that we need to emphasize that, because so much of the power of our faith we see in the parishes that have Eucharistic adoration and those kind of things. That's where the vocations come from.
Yeah.
Those are the dioceses that have those vocations.
That's right.
There's a connection there you can't deny.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, even as you're saying this, I'm remembering certain local parishes, and one of the things that unites them is this fervent love for Christ and a substantial presence in the Eucharist. And there at EWTN, we're still receiving stories of these outstanding testimonies that have come out of the National Eucharistic Congress.
Absolutely. People who have had their faith revitalized. Of course, you hear it all the time. Anyway, we hear it all the time. Over the years and from all corners of the globe, and of course we broadcast this to all corners of the globe, and really in many ways it's kind of unfortunate because the international event down in Quito was kind of overshadowed by the event here in the United States. You know, I mean, and also because the Pope happened to be in the Far East at the same time, so that was probably a double hit on it. But we carried that as well, and you alluded to that earlier. And but it was such a powerful witness, and it's something that continues on. They're going to be doing some other events following up. This isn't a one-and-done kind of thing. You know, let's go have an event, everybody feels good, because that's really the big question. And it's a question we talked a little bit about on an Open Line episode, and we're going to be talking actually with Colin Donovan and Father Joseph Mary Wolf and Father Chris Alar kind of about that on the Catholic Sphere program coming up another month or so, about the idea of the power of the event. But where does that leave us now? What happens when you went back to your parish and you're all enthused and you're all excited and you go home and nobody else is excited and nobody else seems to be interested in what you're trying to accomplish? How much openness is there on the parish level, which is really the Catholic level of our spiritual life? Is there openness to that Eucharistic adoration? How do I get that started in my parish? You know, starting small, getting that Eucharistic procession, those kinds of identities, and the emphasis on the sacrificial nature of the Mass.
Yep. And you bring up this crucial question, right? That, yes, there is a need for national-level revivals, because the Catholic Church takes on this national and eventually global, universal reality. But at the level of the parishes, we want to see that revival take root in the lives of parishioners. So what are some of the things we are seeing coming out of that?
Well, that's really is a big question mark to see.
Yeah,
I mean, obviously, some people have found some positive reactions, and it probably in many cases depended on the particular bishop and the particular diocese as to how involved and committed they were to seeing not only people be there from their locale, but also to see that there is a follow-up, that there is an openness, that there is the bishop's support for these kinds of things to be done in the local parish, and and these are the kinds of things lay people can put together without necessarily having to make it another obligation for somebody at the parish. But you know, because too many times, unfortunately, even with something as glorious as this, you know, people think, oh, it's one more thing I have to do. But this is the most important thing, because this is the thing that keeps people together. And as we said before, we've always seen the fruit when this occurs. And I think to go to that one event with Jonathan Rumi and his t-shirt, which caused a little hubbub, there was the Flannery O'Connor line, which is right on the money, however you want to say it. You know, if it's just a symbol, what are we bothering for?
That's right.
To paraphrase, you know, Bob Lord once said to a priest who said, well, we're nearly not emphasizing the real presence anymore. He said, well, if that's the case, what do we need you for? You got to realize that it's because we believe in these things, because it is really Jesus. That's why we venerate it. If it wasn't really Jesus, then I don't know what we're doing.
Yep, absolutely. And in fact, to everyone else who doesn't believe this is Jesus, they might be looking at us like we're completely absurd, and yet this is the source and summit of the entirety of our life.
Right, exactly. And for some people, unfortunately, and it's a good question for all of us, they'd say, well, if you're really consuming Jesus on a regular basis, I think I should see it more in your life than maybe I am. And that's a good challenge for all of us to say, we are in a unique world as a Catholic to be given this gift. Many of us, as cradle Catholics, and maybe that's why we don't appreciate it, because of the fact that, you know, when you're given something that you never quote-unquote worked for, you don't always appreciate it as much. And so it's important to appreciate this great gift, which so many people are turning their backs on or losing sight of or misunderstanding what it is. In many cases, even inside the church, where people's attempt to make everything the same so everybody feels okay, and we're just generic Christians. We don't want to emphasize the Blessed Mother. We don't want to emphasize the Eucharistic side of these things because that separates us. What they don't understand is that's the truth. And that's what ultimately attracts people. And what we've seen in everywhere else, you know, in the mainline churches, the more you water down the faith, the more people flood out the doors.
That's true. That's completely true. Well, Doug, always a joy to speak with you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
My guest, Doug Keck, President and CEO of EWTN. We are talking about the ongoing fruits of the National Eucharistic Congress, National Eucharistic Revival. And we want to greatly encourage you to procure that book that's coming out. which is a Eucharistic movement. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The most controversial issues may be off the agenda for next month's gathering of the Synod on Synodality in Rome. But make no mistake about it, the October 2nd to 27th gathering could still lead to several big changes that impact daily life in the Catholic Church, including our lives. We're joined by Jonathan Liddle, who is senior editor for The Register, and he is the author of 7 Ways That the Synod on Synodality Can Still Change the Church. Jonathan, thank you for joining us. How are you?
It's great to be with you. I'm well. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So first off, thank you for penning this article. Let's jump right to the issues. We don't have a lot of time, but these are important, concrete ways that the Synod can still change how we operate certain things in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, absolutely. So the hot button issues that have been on everyone's mind throughout the Synod process have related to the Church's sexual teaching and to the possibility of attempting to ordain women. Pope Francis spun those off into separate study groups, so those won't be the focus this coming October in Rome for the Synod. But there are still big ways that the Synod can change the Church, including changing the way that the Church governs and even how it discerns its doctrines and disciplines. So a couple big ones to highlight. Pope Francis has previously talked about sound decentralization in the Church, and one of the proposals that Synod delegates will consider is whether to basically supercharge episcopal conferences. So these are national bishops' conferences. Mm-hmm. You think of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops as an example. Right now, in canon law, these episcopal conferences are not juridical bodies. They don't have their own doctrinal authority, their own discipline. They're there to help facilitate the life of the Church in a particular country. But this proposal is to essentially give them the power to decide doctrinal questions and discipline in that specific country. There is language about how they can't break away from communion with the universal Church, but it's mm-hmm. still very unclear how that will play off, and definitely raising concerns for people while we have processes like the Synodal Way in Germany, right, that's very much pushing for significant changes in church doctrine and discipline.
And again, you've got that concern of ambiguity, right? So we know that there's been a call for sound decentralization. There's been a call for greater influence of these local Episcopal conferences. But there's no clarity as to what that will look like. And that can cause some level of concern.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the document on that issue and many others, maybe I'll get into one right after this, but it kind of does hold up, what some people might say are competing principles. And so some people might say, well, how do you square the circle? How do you allow a regional Episcopal conference to have doctrinal authority while still ensuring that there's a unity of faith and practice of the universal church? Maybe one other one to jump into is there's this interesting language about changing the way canon law talks about consultative vote. So in many places, a pastoral council for a diocese, a bishop consults lay people and other people, but at the end of the day, it's the bishop making the decision.
Yep.
So the Instrumentum Laboris, though, it sort of, on the one hand, acknowledges the bishop's teaching authority that's part of the hierarchical structure of the church established by Christ, but on the other hand, it says the lay faithful, the sensus fidei, has a way of sort of determining what the right course of action is. And there's even language about how the canon law formula that speaks of these pastoral councils having only a consultative vote only should be corrected because it diminishes the value of consultation. So again, we don't know exactly how they're going to square that circle, how they're going to thread that needle of something, of giving lay faithful more than a consultative vote in decision-making while also still respecting the integrity of the bishop's teaching authority.
Right, and not just the Episcopal order, but also the order of the ordained hierarchy, right? That there really is a delineation of office here that the church has always honored in that hierarchy.
Yeah, and I think this is maybe brings us to another big change that the Synod is proposing, which is really expanding the role and the placement of women in the church. Exactly the point you raised. Many will argue that the church has long had an argument or an understanding of holy orders equipping someone not just to celebrate Mass, but really to exercise pastoral leadership and governance.
Yep,
right?
Exactly.
But we've seen changes already in the Francis Pontificate of, for instance, making a religious sister a secretary of one of the curias, dicasteries. And the Instrumentum Laboris is calling for more of that. So expanding, women, to basically assume responsibility in dioceses and different organs of the church, really anywhere where it's not required for someone to basically celebrate the sacrament. So that's
right.
A much bigger theological conundrum, right, that people see perhaps shifting currently in the pontificate of Francis, and then also definitely with the Synod on Synodality.
And thus far, everything that you've brought up, they're not without their critics, and critics have warned that these could anyway from lead to a potential upturn of the present status quo to even leading churches going their own way on issues of doctrine and discipline. So we've yet to see how they shake out. What about the question of bishop evaluations?
Yeah, that's another one that was proposed in a section on transparency and accountability. It says, for a long time we've had superiors evaluating people under them, but there's not as much culture in the church of charges evaluating their superiors. So there is a proposal to develop essentially a system of holding bishops and also in a parochial setting, a pastor sort of to account, people providing feedback to them. The document does stress that this should be understood in a non-moralistic sense. People who I've talked to who, for instance, are upset with the way that parish closures or mergers are happening in their diocese might appreciate something like this. But I think it, again, raises the question, a pastor is supposed to have in really an intrinsic and essential way a spiritual relationship with his people.
Right.
And if we use evaluative processes that, McKinsey Consulting Group could provide to you and, reduce the relationship between pastor and flock to just a matter of evaluation that way, I think it really does raise a couple questions. One, it raises how free the pastor will be to actually decide things, where he has that authority. And then, two, I think there's concern that it could just create a dynamic where, even more so, the parish priest, the pastor feels like some kind of business administrator and less like a spiritual father, which I think is something that, that everyone could agree with would be a great shame if that happened.
Right. A great shame and travesty to largely to the office, especially in terms of this whole thing is couched under the intent of combating clericalism. But the potential here could be the detriment of that spiritual father relationship over the flock.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think many people of goodwill will say, hey, clericalism is something that we can continue to refine. You know, priests should see their ministry as a ministry of service. And other parts of the world, I'll say, you know, places in Africa or Latin America, perhaps the clericalist culture is a little more endemic than it is in a place like the United States. But of course, you know, it's that the classic kind of image, you know, you move some fence post out in the middle of a field. You don't know why it's there. Next thing you know, the cows are getting free. Just to say that, yeah, there are these efforts to do it, but I think the question is, how can you hold together the integrity of holy orders, the integrity of the ecclesiology of the church that Christ instituted, that's been taught throughout the ages, that Vatican II reaffirmed? How can we do this both end? And I think that is still kind of an open question as we head into this final session of the Synod on Synodality.
That's right. And then you've got language of a ministry of listening, of greater inter-ecclesial communication. So just share with, shed some light on that for us.
Yeah, the ministry of listening is a very interesting concrete proposal that kind of emerged in 2023's October session on the Synod on Synodality. And really, it's proposed as a sort of instituted ministry in the church where, you know, someone will be sort of, you know, empowered to be that kind of open door to the wider ecclesial community with a special concern perhaps for people who feel unheard or marginalized. And also this role, the document speaks about this minister of listening, helping to facilitate a kind of communal discernment in the diocese. So we'll see. The details of that will emerge at the end of October, and if not then, maybe perhaps in the future, but we'll stay tuned.
Thank you, Jonathan. My guest, Jonathan Liddle, senior editor for The Register. We've been talking about some ways in which the next session of the Synod on Synodality might still change the way we operate as a church. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Have you ever been so grief-stricken and so heartsick that you can't see God? You can't see God in the tragedy. You can't see God in that cross. You can't see God in that sin. Why? You're enveloped in that grief. You're enveloped in fear. And God is out the window. You don't see Him standing right next to you.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
This October 8th, our sponsor, Spirit Juice Studios, presents the full story of a hero, narrated by Jonathan Rumi.
Father Flanagan lived his life by a simple principle, that we are all children of God, and it is our responsibility to care for one another.
Heart of a Servant, the Father Flanagan story, rated PG-13. Tickets and info at fatherflanaganfilm.com. That's fatherflanaganfilm.com. Exclusively in theaters nationwide, October 8th.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
He's not on drugs. Parents will come into my office and describe a litany of trouble about this long. Then they'll say this: I'm giving you the wrong impression. Overall, he's a pretty good kid. How so? Well, he's not on drugs or anything like that. One of the new moral high bars out there. He's not on drugs. You want to raise a child not with the absence of pathology, but with the presence of virtue. She's miserable with me, but she treats everybody else great. Again, not the absence of bad behavior, but the presence of good behavior. He's not on drugs? It's a rationale. It may provide some comfort. It's not a path to virtue.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John 14. This is Jesus in the upper room with the disciples before he's going out to his sacrifice of himself for our salvation. And Philip says to the Lord, "Show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied." Jesus looks at Philip and says, "Philip, have I been with you all this time? Don't you understand? When you see me, you're looking at the Father." In fact, only two people throughout human history have given rise to the question, not who is he, but what is he? The two people are Buddha and Jesus. Buddha's answer was, don't come to me, don't look to me, look to my doctrine, look to what I teach. Jesus's answer was, come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart. Jesus is explicitly claiming to be God.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. This question of consciousness as it pertains to the modern scientific sphere is one that Catholics have to engage, largely because it is part of the parlance in terms of the definition of the human person and questions about life and death. Joining me to have this conversation is Dr. Stephen Doran, husband, father, experienced and respected neurosurgeon, and you can have insights. One of his series is entitled The Final Journey, Insights from a Catholic Doctor and Neurosurgeon, and you can visit his work at stephendoran.com. Stephen, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me, Marcus. This is a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. So let's start in terms of definitions, this question of consciousness, right? This is not a classic theological, philosophical definition when it comes to the term of consciousness as a faculty in the intellect. So how do we understand consciousness in light of Catholic teachings?
Well, I think the challenge is that a very famous neuroscientist named Chalmers said, you know, there is nothing we know more intimately than consciousness or conscious experience, but there's nothing harder to explain. So we understand what, and that we intuit being conscious. Like one person said, consciousness is something I lose when I go to bed at night and something I gain when I wake up. But there's a whole different layers of complexity to consciousness. But as a physician, as a surgeon, I kind of look at it in a more very concrete way, where I see consciousness in terms of being awake and alert and what that experience involves. And so there's, you know, all sorts of conscious experience, what we see, hear, taste, you know, our senses, those things. But also our mental imagery, our memories, and our conscious thoughts. So in just a very high level, that's what consciousness means, to be aware, to be awake, to be interactive with our environments.
Mm-hmm. So on a theological level, that presents questions pertaining to the passive intellect, right? You've got your capacity of processing the sentient appetite, those things that are within the senses. But you're also talking about memory. You're talking about understanding, intellection, imagination. So this term consciousness roughly encompasses the almost full extent of the intellectual capacities of the human person.
It does, and I think sometimes people think, well, what does this have to do with my faith life, me being a Catholic, faithful Catholic? It matters everything, because how we treat people oftentimes, whether we realize it or not, is oftentimes based upon a judgment of their level or state of consciousness, you know, at the end of life, or people who are disabled, or people who have, mental challenges, dementia, all sorts of things get wrapped up into consciousness. So it really, really does matter that we have understanding of this, and also what sort of preeminence do we place on consciousness, and to what extent has that become the definition of being human? Because I think there's a lot of people who think that our consciousness is what defines us as humans, and And I would push back and I would say, no, that's not the case. I think from a Catholic thinking, we place the emphasis on our humanity, our being, mm-hmm. as being this, our souls and our body are intimately related to each other, are integrated with each other, and then when death occurs, when the soul leaves the body. And so that's our basic understanding of that, but there's other people who would push back and say, no, death is something different than that. And so it really means we have to understand what the soul is in relationship to consciousness. They're not the same thing, but mm-hmm. they're very intimately related to each other. And so we have to be able to distinguish, our soul from consciousness, but realize they're very much tied to one another. And so therefore we make judgments of importance from a Catholic perspective, more based upon our soul than our consciousness. But I think the culture would want to do it the other way. They'd want to emphasize consciousness.
And that's the problem, right? Having this conversation in the modern sphere, especially in terms of talking about consciousness as a faculty in the intellective power of the soul, you need to acknowledge a soul, and then you need to acknowledge that a human person is a body-soul composite. And you can't have those conversations. So you've got one perspective of reductive materialism. You've got another perspective of, I think, therefore I am. So this Jean-Jacques Rousseau concept of my real self is within, waiting to break out. And both of these present problems.
Yes, they do. And I think that people want to... sometimes people ignore the reality that our souls have... and I'm going to readily admit right here and now, Marcus, I am a brain surgeon. I'm not a philosopher, so mm-hmm. you can correct me on some of these things. But the reality is that the intellectual capacities of our soul, that's not the only part of our, that's not all our soul, the only power of our soul. But mm-hmm. I think even some people who maybe try to appeal to, quiescence and things like that, will sometimes forget the fact that the intellectual powers of the soul are not the only powers of the soul, mm-hmm. and that the other capacities and powers of the soul are present also. It's only when all the capacities, all the powers of the soul are no longer active does the person actually die. I mean, we know, of course, the soul lives on forever, but it's at that moment when the soul has lost all its powers and within our body that it becomes separated mm-hmm. and lives on forever in a distinct state. Now, the soul can exist and it does exist apart from the body, but it's not in its natural perfection. The natural perfection is when the body and soul are together, and that will be realized again at the second coming when with the resurrection of the dead. Another one of these things that we don't quite think about a lot sometimes as Catholics, but when with the resurrection of the dead, the soul returns to its natural perfection when it's united with the body. So soul and consciousness are super important in Catholic thought, whether we realize it or not.
Right. And so what you said just presents a massive problem too when it comes to dialogues of questions of brain death, right? Mm-hmm. You've got John Paul II, Benedict XVI. They present to you provisional assent to the notion of brain death because even they recognize the issues of just reducing the human person to cognitive functioning.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the soul is not reducible to the brain, mm-hmm. And I think some people want to make that jump. The issue of brain death has actually become more and more in the forefront of our public discussions because, historically, people were dead when they were dead. When you stop breathing and when your heart stopped, the old Western movies, they'd hold a mirror to the nose fog up. But only with the advent of organ transplantation, it became like, oh, wait a minute, how can we get this organ, how do we get this heart, the very first heart transplant from someone who's alive? Wouldn't that be killing them? Mm-hmm. And so very quickly, the idea of brain death criteria was developed by Harvard and by and large accepted widely. Basically, it said that a person was dead when their entire brain was dead. And both Benedict and John Paul have given what I would consider provisional endorsement of both of those things. But what's happened, so historically when someone was brain dead, even with maximal medical support, very quickly the rest of the organs would deteriorate and the person mm-hmm. would die despite everybody's efforts. Well, with technology improving, now we can sustain an individual who's been declared brain dead for a long period of time, weeks or even months sometimes. Pregnant women who were declared brain dead, who were the baby was able to continue to grow, and the baby's delivered weeks or even months later. And even recently, they've been doing experiments on individuals who were declared brain dead. And they, with the permission of their family, put in a genetically modified pig kidney to see if that would work in humans. And so, again, this is it's just kind of a little bit mind-bending here. So, wait a minute, is this person dead? Then you're doing experiments on a corpse. If they're not dead, they're doing... Anyway, so anyway, our technology has allowed us to sustain people much longer now than it used to. So that has raised this question, is a brain-dead person really dead? And that's a process that's being worked through in many ways right now. And I think I don't want to induce any sort of doubt into the transplantation system or anything like that, but it is something that's being really looked at again more carefully right as we speak right now.
My guest, Dr. Stephen Doran, husband, father, experienced neurosurgeon, and you can follow his work at stephendoran.com. We are continuing this conversation on the other side of the break. What is consciousness? Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
We are the pro-life generation, passionate about building the culture of life in our healthcare and in our nation. But not all healthcare options are equally pro-life, and some provide morally objectionable procedures. CMF Curo is different. CMF Curo is a pro-life Catholic healthcare ministry providing a pathway for its members to build the culture of life in their healthcare choices, not destroy it. Learn more about CMF Curo at MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes, without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
It is really important to make time for silence or to listen to peaceful music within that silence if it helps you pray, which it does me. And how interesting that scripture is filled with different reminders about silence. And the natural law shows us that what, once again, scripture is telling us is absolutely true. For example, according to health experts, silence may help you in several ways, including lowering your blood pressure, improving concentration and focus, calming racing thoughts, and stimulating brain growth. Our Blessed Mother knew this. We see this in Scripture repeatedly, and Mary pondered this in her heart.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Why do we have confession? According to the Catholic Catechism, Christ instituted the sacrament of penance for the sinful members of his church, especially those who had fallen into grave sin, thus losing their baptismal grace and wounding their ecclesial communion. Over the centuries, the administration of the sacrament has evolved. In the early church, penitents guilty of particularly grave offenses such as idolatry, murder, adultery, were required to do public penance, sometimes for years before receiving reconciliation. In the 7th century, Irish missionaries, inspired by Eastern monastic tradition, brought the practice of private penance to Europe. This effectively ended public penance before forgiveness, making the sacrament essentially between penitent and priest, as it is today. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. My guest, Dr. Stephen Doran, neurosurgeon, who writes and puts up his work at stephendoran.com, and we are talking about the question of the scientific assessment of consciousness. So, Stephen, before the break, we were talking earlier about the problem with defining a person's death by means of brain death, because it's too reductionistic a view of the... essentially, you're talking about the integral union of the body-soul composite, which science doesn't possess the capacity to truly honor.
Right, and that's true. Yet, there ultimately, we are called upon to make some of these judgments, though, we're at times need to be able to say someone is indeed dead, right? And so, but you're right, that's a metaphysical, spiritual, theological question, and when the soul leaves the body, that isn't something that I learned in my anatomy classes,
right.
You know? And so, but, you know, the idea of consciousness and where it's really important in our values and how we treat patients can be also seen in this idea that there's, I think sometimes people think that you're either conscious or you're not, like it's a on-off type of thing. And the reality is there's a whole continuum of consciousness and level of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And ranging from being normal, presumably you and I are normal and we're talking together, that's a normal level of consciousness. And on the other extreme, what we were just visiting about brain death, but there's other things in between. And these issues also are super important because, you know, people can be in what's called the minimally conscious state or what used to be called the vegetative state,
which
we don't use that anymore, the unresponsive wakefulness syndrome. I think many people remember famously the Terry Schiavo case, you know. And so here's a person who was not brain dead. They weren't normal. They were in one of these phases in between, probably closely the unresponsive wakefulness syndrome. So the value judgment that came there that brought this all to the forefront is whether or not this person should be receive nutrition and hydration or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it became this a very public case. Her husband wanted to withdraw the support. Her family opposed it. And it was a very public case because we believe as Catholics that there's certain basic human rights that all of us have.
Yeah.
The right to be sheltered, the right to have clothing, the right to be receive nutrition, hydration.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a basic fundamental right that we all have. And so cases like this all of a sudden bring to question, well, wait a minute, is this person entitled to the same rights that everybody else is? We would never think of course, putting a newborn baby out in the cold snowbank and not feed or clothe them. That would be infanticide. So in the same way, we start making value judgments on someone like Terry Schiavo and then other cases like that, because their consciousness isn't normal.
Right.
And therefore, at what point are they no longer, quote, human, end quote? You know, some people want to tie our humanity entirely to having a rational capacity for, but we believe, no, that's not true. And so these value judgments are super important, that we can't place this preeminence on normal levels of consciousness,
right,
on how we treat people.
And this expands the horizon of the conversation to even individuals who are not otherwise in what would have formerly been called a vegetative state, but who don't have normative rational capacities. You know, parents of children who, for one reason or another, have severe intellectual defects, right? In those circumstances, the argument can be made for the fact that they don't have consciousness the way normative conversational competencies would dictate. So, in that situation, we move down a path in society where we're arguing for the right to define that these people don't deserve to live. I mean, the whole question of assisted suicide revolves around that.
Right. Yeah. When we start applying judgments on value above and beyond just your intrinsic value as a human person and start creating some sort of artificial grading scale, well, you're less than human, therefore
right,
this or whatever. It's, you know, people, use the word slippery slope. It really is. I mean, that's a cliche term, but it really is true. And when you talk about assisted suicide, you see how the slippery slope of assisted suicide euthanasia initially starts off with very controlled, mm-hmm. you know, circumstances, but within a short time, the people who are eligible for assisted suicide euthanasia becomes larger and larger.
Right.
In Canada, for example, which has really expanded their indications for that. So in order to consent for assisted suicide, and in Canada it's active euthanasia, you have to be able to give consent. Well, someone who has dementia, for example, I think everybody would agree is not capable of giving consent. Mm-hmm. Well, now in Canada, there's laws being proposed that you can have, in a sense, an advance directive saying, well, in the event my consciousness becomes impaired, I become demented, you have my permission now to commit euthanasia on me. So this whole people are kind of anticipating that, hey, there might be a time when my consciousness isn't normal.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if I'm not in a position to make that decision because I'm no longer fully conscious, please right. make that decision for me. So people are even kind of proactively anticipating that I don't want to be alive if I'm not, quote, fully conscious.
And you know, this raises that whole issue of a reductive materialistic mm-hmm. worldview of life,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember teaching in California for just under a year, and this question of, well, allow them to die with dignity,
mm-hmm.
right? As if the dignified death is one where the individual is in complete control of the terms of their death, without regard to the divinely endowed dignity of the human person for whom they are accountable to when they breathe their last.
Yeah, I think that I wrote a book called To Die Well, mm-hmm. and so the idea of what is a good death, well, what is not a good death is kind of exactly what you just, well, let me take that back. That cannot be the ultimate measure of a good death, mm-hmm. one that is controlled, pain-free, surrounded by family. But that's wonderful. Of course, that's a nice thing to die in those circumstances. But if that becomes the measure of a good death, well, that's the next step is a very quick step to say, well, I want that death, and I'm gonna control my death in such a way. I'm gonna orchestrate things so that I do die pain-free, surrounded by family, in a nice environment.
Mm-hmm.
But we know and believe with absolute certainty the measure of good death is not that at all, because we believe in a savior who had everything yeah. but that. He was isolated. He was separated from his those who supported him, with very few exceptions. He had a horrible, you know, tortured to death.
Yeah.
Yeah, we point towards appropriately, this is the good death par excellence.
Yep.
That's the best death that we can point towards. So we have to be really careful on how we, what values we assign to what constitutes a good life,
right.
a good death, things like that.
Which means that in the face of the crucifixion of Christ, which is death par excellence for the human person, and the modern definition of what it means to die with quote-unquote dignity, really we have substituted true good for pleasure, and therefore the pleasurable death, the death where I endure the least amount of pain possible. And modern science has done a lot to alleviate the horizon of pain in human existence. But the downside to that is we have become a society that's completely averse to even an ounce of pain and suffering, and that defines how we want to die as well.
You know what's interesting, Marcus, is that if you look at the statistics from the individuals who are seeking out assisted suicide or euthanasia, the main reason that they choose to seek it out is not fear of pain. That's mm-hmm. like way down the list. It's loss of autonomy,
mm.
loss of control. And what does that say to us as a community of believers? Like isolation is their fear. In some ways, we're kind of criticizing those who seek out euthanasia, assisted suicide, and we criticize those who provide it, and especially we should criticize those who provide it. But I think we have to turn the mirror on ourselves a little bit and say, what does this say about us? What does it say about us when the number one, the top reasons that people are seeking this out is fear of being a burden or isolation or loss of autonomy? Those are things that normal, everyday, you don't have to be heroic mm-hmm. in those situations to help somebody. You just have to be there. You have to
right.
be present. It's nothing, you know, heroic to do it. Just being human with those other, our fellow humans.
Right. And again, this presents that other aspect of the conversation, which is it's sometimes seemingly charitable to want to allow the loved one to opt for euthanasia or assisted suicide, when in reality, the charitable thing to do is to brave this suffering with them. To allow them to pass through the veil in as dignified a divine manner as possible.
That's true. I think that what our role is in being present with those who are nearing death is to be with them. And it's almost a cliche now, the accompaniment, but it's true. That just being present. There's a great book by Monsignor Albacete that talks about suffering, and he says in the presence of suffering, we do violence to try to explain it away to the other person. If I'm accompanying somebody who's suffering and I try to explain it away or provide nice truisms for it, that does violence to that person. What we're called to do is to be present with mm-hmm. them and to show them Christ. If in no other way, just to be present. I was with one of my partners whose wife died unexpectedly, and I went up to the hospital with her with him, and we just sat there and we knelt there at the bedside. I don't know if 10 words were exchanged, and it was just being there. And he looks back at that as just that, and I look at it as just this super powerful experience of being in solidarity with each other, in solidarity with God,
yeah.
with no agenda, with no attempts to try to explain things away or, try to theologize about the good that's going to come about us. Just being present to the person who's dying and suffering is something we can all do.
Yeah, I recall being at the deathbed of particular loved ones, and mm-hmm. There's a certain surrealness of the experience that we discount if we look at it from a purely reductionistic perspective.
Yes, yes.
So, Stephen, if people would like to reach you and find out more about the work you do, how can they do that?
Well, there is. I do have a website, stephendoren.com. It's Stephen is S-T-E-P-H-E-N, doren.com. Mm-hmm. Also, my wife and I are in a ministry, Seeking Truth Catholic Bible Study. Huge part of our life together. Scripture, if I always tell people whenever I get a chance to talk, forget about everything else I said, but just read the Bible.
Yes.
Just get into God's Word. And so that's been a huge part of our marriage. It's been a huge part of bringing God's word to the people of Omaha and beyond. So that's another way they can contact me or my wife. And so those are the ways I can be reached.
Well, thank you, Stephen. As we round off this hour, I want to draw all of us to the reality that God made us as body-soul composite beings. Our material constituent principle of our bodies is not a mistake, and it is joined intrinsically to our soul. This body is what we will have at the end of time, at the resurrection of the body, united forever in the beatific vision, hopefully. So, let's live lives in a manner that's worthy of the calling that's been given us as children of the Father. Until next time, for Ave Maria in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.